This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Tom Hanks' 12-part HBO miniseries about the Apollo space program, From the Earth to the Moon, leads the Emmy pack with 17 nominations. Hanks is up for Best Directing for a miniseries or movie. He was also the executive producer of the series. It begins with President Kennedy's 1961 challenge to send a man to the moon and ends in 1972 with the last moonwalk. Hanks directed one episode and wrote the final one, but he doesn't appear as an actor. Terry spoke with him in April.
Tom Hanks, you directed the first episode, which is about the very beginning of the space program.
Yes.
John Kennedy's challenge to have a man on the moon by the end of the 60s. And that episode ends with the Gemini 8 mission that had to abort. Why did you decide to direct that particular episode?
Well, I knew that it was going to be problematic and that we were going to have to bust a bunch of rules as far as being a quote-unquote pilot episode for what a series is. There were there was an ocean of faces that we had to establish and yet not linger on very long in order to get anybody to know. And there was a huge volume of information that we just needed to lay down. In show business parlance, it's called shoe leather or pipe. You have to, like, essentially set the stage for what is our real story. There's not a single Apollo launch in the first episode. It's all one Mercury mission and four Gemini missions that are, by and large, forgotten. And I felt as though that with as long as script that constantly stayed in flux right up until we were, actually until just last December, where we shot some extra scenes for it in order to flesh it out, I knew that there was going to be this odd and undefined sort of logic that would have to be established by this first episode, and I honestly didn't know what it was. I couldn't give that over to a screenwriter or a director and say, listen, I don't know what this thing is, but go off and shoot it. We'll make sense of it later on. I am a member of the DGA, so I could say, well, you know what, I'm going to volunteer for what is not the it's kind of grunt work here, but I'll do some heavy lifting here, and hopefully at the end of it we'll have, honestly, it's not even an overture, it's more like a prelude to the rest of the series, trusting that no one really would be able to figure that out except me and a few other trusted advisors on the show.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, one of the things that you have in that first episode is the first walk in space.
Yes, Ed White's walk in space.
So how did you stage that?
Well,
this is a scene where the an astronaut's in space attached by like an umbilical cord to the spacecraft.
Yes. There were five things that needed to be proven before anybody could go to the moon. And one of them was that it was going to be possible for a human being to get outside of a spacecraft in the vacuum of outer space. That a suit could be developed and that he would be able to live and breathe and survive however long it took, because obviously you can't walk on the moon without getting outside of the spacecraft. So this was something that had never been done before except by Alexei Leonov a few months prior to Ed White. And this was always one of the big things about the first episode. We were going to show this in such a way to an audience, by the way, that has become, you know, honestly, they've seen this 100 million times in any number of science fiction films or television series. That is, if we're going to try to bring it back in a oddly operatic, poetic, balletic sort of fashion, so they would understand that, wow, now wait, that's a cool thing to understand, that the idea of opening a hatch as you're flying 5 miles a second, you know, 200 miles above the planet Earth, and then getting out and drifting around on a gold umbilical cord would probably be a very beautiful thing. As it turns out, it was very uncomfortable. It was very physically demanding of Ed White. It was not an easy thing to do. But you know what? We just sat down and said, okay, how are we going to do this? And it's a sequence that has almost every one of the current modes of special effects photography in it. We do models. There is some computer-generated animation. There is a stuntman that's hanging from a tether. There is a stuntman standing on a floor as the camera does some interesting things. And we just sort of like figured it out, a way to get from that hatch opening up to the final moments when he gets back inside.
You know, it's funny. I think our ideas of space have been formed at least as much by movies like 2001 and TV series like Star Trek as by the actual flights. And Tom Hanks, I read that you saw 2001 22 times in a theater.
Well, it's now over 30. It's over 30 now. As a matter of fact,
this was long before you started making space movies.
I've seen it projected. That's the big deal. I have it on Laserdisc, and I've watched sequences of it. But yeah, I've seen it projected. As a matter of fact, it was just re-released about 2 years ago, and it played in the Cinerama Dome here in Los Angeles. And I was one of about 42 people at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, sitting in and watching again. And lo and behold, I see something new every time I see the film.
So, what did you see in it initially that got you back 22 times? Before you started seeing it.
I can tell you quite easily. It was the two sequences of the flight of the Pan Am space shuttle to the Blue Danube, and then the flight of the Ares 1B mooncraft, also to the Blue Danube, that is carrying Dr. Heywood Floyd to the moon. The thing you have to remember, what I consider about 2001, is that this was not a fantastic, impossible future that we were seeing, rendered by Stanley Kubrick. This was literally what was going to happen. All of the spacecraft, procedures that we saw these characters doing, riding around and upside down in a circular space station, strapped down in a space shuttle. This was the physical reality of the direction that the hardware was going. We weren't seeing like rocket ships that were shaped like discs. We weren't seeing Lost in Space with the Space Family Robinson. We were seeing where the next generation of the Apollo spacecraft and the shuttle was. So this we were literally having a window into the future of what it was going to be like within our lifetimes. Yeah. I remember thinking, I'm going to be 44 in the year 2000, yeah. And that means by that time we'll be able to watch that space station go over our house, yeah. And it's going to look just like that because that's what it's based on in physics. And this is the reason that I went back again and again and again and again, because I was seeing in real life, I was looking at the first draft of 2001 A Space Odyssey in the form of Apollo's 8 and Apollo 11 and Apollo 12. And this was just going to be a few years in the future.
Tom Hanks, from an interview Terry recorded this spring. His HBO miniseries about the Apollo space program is nominated for 17 Emmys. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview Terry recorded in April with Tom Hanks. He's the executive producer of the Emmy-nominated series From the Earth to the Moon. Terry also spoke with him about his acting career, including films Forrest Gump and Apollo 13.
What did you learn from Apollo 13 about how to and how not to shoot space scenes?
Well, actually, inside the command and lunar modules, it's really not that difficult because, honestly, we were on teeter-totters or just standing on apple boxes, and you can tilt the camera to make it look anything. You can do a lot inside these very controlled atmospheres. The real mold that we broke on Apollo 13, I think, was truly trusting the audience to understand what we're talking about. There is a philosophy that says, look, the audience doesn't know anything about orbital mechanics, so we can't hang any dialogue talking about orbital mechanics. Yes, we can, because it's going to be like, they see a movie in French and it's subtitled. After a while, they forget that they're reading the subtitles and they're just hearing the French, but they're understanding it. The idea of, okay, rocket ship, go! Retro rockets, fire! we had a lot of, we got the IDC aligns, we're going to have, we had the whole lessons about what gimbal lock is. The audience didn't need to understand gimbal lock. They just had to know that gimbal lock was a bad thing. And we were able to communicate that after a number of forays into the transcripts.
What impact did it have on you to play Jim Lovell in Apollo 13? And did you get to meet him and find out what impact it had on him for you to have told his story?
Well, it was actually, I was very afraid of my countenance being used in order to be portraying an astronaut, because I was, oddly enough, I had swallowed the myth, hook, line, and sinker, of the iron-jawed, steely-eyed, throttle jockey aspect that has really been spoon-fed to us as though we get our sense of history from Wheaties boxes. And by meeting Jim, and realizing that on first glance you would assume that Jim is a successful dentist or a well-read insurance agent. He's not a tall man, he's not a muscular man, he's not a scary man, he's not an intimidating man. He is just this really great guy who, you find out, has made 100 night landings on an aircraft carrier in the Sea of Japan, and by the way, was one of the first three men to leave the Earth's gravitational pull, orbit the moon, and come back, and was also the commander of Apollo 13. To realize that these guys who were literally interplanetary explorers, or the closest thing we have to interplanetary explorers, are not all that different from you or I, that indeed somebody who has my countenance and my outlook and the same attitude when he gets out of bed could indeed be someone who leaves the planet Earth. That was something of an eye-opening catharsis for me, and made me feel as though, you know what, I'm the perfect guy to play Jim Lovell. At first I thought I was as far removed, but after meeting him and getting to know him and hanging around him, I realized that if you're going to cast somebody to play Jim Lovell, you better come and get me.
You directed the first episode in this new From the Earth to the Moon series. What's the best direction you've ever had in a movie that you weren't directing but you were acting in?
Oh, do it different. That was it. It was literally, just do that different. You get to the point where you're an actor and you think that what your job is to sit at home the night before and say, okay, here's how I'm going to do this. Here's how I'm going to say this line. And when this moment comes, I'm going to turn. I'm going to give this look. And what that look is going to communicate is everything that I want communicated in the scene. And that's what I'm going to do. And you think that that's what your job is. Well, you know, your job is to get there and tell the truth according to the dictates of the scene. Spencer Tracy said this. He said, the actor's job is to hit the marks and tell the truth. You have to be in the reality of that very specific moment. And there are times that, I mean, this was very, you know what, I'll tell you. It was in a TV movie I did called Rona Jaffe's Mazes and Monsters. And the director said to me, you know, that was great. That was fine. That was okay. Do it different. And I thought, whoa, do it different. My God, man. I've done all this preparation for this. This is what you don't understand. I'm an artist. But in a moment, a light went off in my head, a great illumination, I might add, that said, oh, I see what he's saying. I see what he's saying.
What was he saying? Yeah,
he's saying that was fake and
right.
That was baloney. And that's what you want us to believe is going on. But you know what? We can see that you've just made these arbitrary choices in order to make it seem as though you're undergoing something. And in fact, I'm not believing it. So please do something different. And that demands a lot of things. That demands a certain fluidity and as well as a trusting of the text itself, as opposed to your sole interpretation of what that text is.
So when you, as a director, have to tell an actor to do it different, are those the words that you'd use, or is there a nice or a not nice way of putting that?
There's other ways of doing it. Hopefully you've had enough communication with your actors prior to that, so you sort of speak the same language. And I must say, you know, I'm perfectly willing to take that kind of blatant direction from guys. But there's ways of doing it. So you can come and say, you know what, this Nora Ephron does this a lot. I'm making a movie with her right now. Nora always comes up and
she wrote Sleepless in Seattle.
She wrote Sleepless in Seattle and directed it. And she says, you know what this moment is? This is the moment where you know that you're doing the right thing, but in fact you're not doing the right thing. And there's an infinite possibilities of what she means there, and I think I do understand what she means. And so you end up going off down this road, and that is essentially a very cool way and a very polite way of saying, do something different. Because who knows, you know, when they put this movie together 6 months from now, that one thing that you are providing and recreating over and over again may not be the thing that's going to make the scene. And so you have to trust the fact that there is a degree of serendipity that goes into your performance on any given day that can make or break that scene and therefore the whole enterprise.
You wrote, directed, and co-starred in the film That Thing You Do a couple of years ago, which was set in the same era as your space series. It was set in 1964.
Those go-go 60s.
About a small town rock band that becomes a one-hit wonder. And I guess I'm wondering if those two themes are connected in your mind, you know, this one-hit wonder rock band of the 60s and the moon flights.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm 41 years old, and I have a degree of the disease that everybody else my age has.
That my era is the most important era.
Well, you know what? Yes, exactly right. The people who are 10 years older than us think differently, and the people who are 10 years younger than us think differently as well. I must say, I look back on those. We were just talking about when I was 9 years old. I could probably remember moments when I was 9 years old better than I can remember moments from when I was 39 years old, because they were so indelible. And all I can remember is the Beatles were so cool, and there was nothing more magical than the Ed Sullivan Show when the Beatles were going to be on it. And I remember distinctly walking across that playground in Mrs. Castle's class to sit in the auditorium to watch a Jiminy capsule sit on top of an Atlas booster and go nowhere for hours on end. And it was I'm not a great filmmaker. I'm not a great storyteller. I'm some guy who works in the movies. But you know what? When it comes down to the stuff that I really do have a passion for, and I think I can recreate on paper, it always always, it's going to come out of my own experience somehow, especially right now. And these things that are so powerful for me are truly, I can tell you, the big three from my life are the Beatles, and it is the Apollo space program, and it is Vietnam. I still ponder all three of those things over and over again. Well, I read them as hobbies.
It's interesting that you mentioned Vietnam, because I think for a lot of people during the Vietnam War, the space program had a sense almost of irrelevance or of misplaced values. You know, we're fighting this war, we're killing people in another country, there's poverty in our own neighborhoods, and yet we're sending men to the moon. I mean, some people were really quite outraged about that. How did you reconcile that?
Well, we just pay homage to the fact that they were going on hand in hand.
Right.
We are our fourth episode, which is entitled 1968, which is about the Apollo 8 mission. It really chronicles month by month everything that went on in that year, starting in January and ending in December. The cruel twist of fate in regards to the Apollo moon program is that it did happen as a bookend to Vietnam in tandem. And here was this thing that was siphoning off so much of our attention, so much of our grief, and so much of our money to a tragic and oppressive end, really. I mean, there was no escaping Vietnam at the time. Well, and on the other side of it, here was this altruistic thing that was expanding the horizons of humankind that was also costing an awful lot of money.
Where did you find the right body language and voice for Forrest Gump? What did you look in yourself for that?
Well, the first thing that I understood about Forrest when it began was that he couldn't operate faster than his own common sense. That's the one thing that I got from reading it. That's the one thing I presented to Bob Zemeckis and Eric Roth, who wrote it. I said, look, I don't know anything about this guy, except he can't operate fast in his own common sense. So that automatically made him, quote-unquote, slow or hesitant and not very verbal. Everything else, I must say, came through this long period of bad experimentation on my part of trying to find this guy. And it didn't honestly click in until the young actor who played the young Forrest and I met. And we did some camera tests, screen tests here in Los Angeles about maybe a month or 2 months prior to beginning of shooting. I just said, Lord, this kid is perfect. And I had a brief conversation with Bob. I said, look, don't have this kid change anything. Don't make him do anything that I have ideas. That's going to be virtually impossible. Let me just take him. He was a fascinating kid. He was a good kid. And he had this distinctive way of talking that I was following him around with a tape recorder and then sat down with the dialogue coach, a woman by the name of Jessica Drake. And I said, okay, how do we make this an organic thing that comes out of my mouth? And what we did in the 2 weeks prior to beginning the shooting was we slowly read the entire screenplay out loud. I read it to her. Every page number, every exterior, Forrest Gump's house. It is a sunny day on the river, and Forrest is mowing the lawn. You know, and I said everybody's dialogue. I said every fade in. I said every fade out. I said every cut to. And it took a real long time. But by the time we were done, it was locked in my head enough so that I could put on the clothes and go out and be Forrest.
Right. I'm curious about the ideas that you rejected for the role.
Oh, they were pretty bad. You know, it's like bad Southern accents. And I must say that this is a really. You talk about how you prepare to do this, and you have to fail horribly before you can figure any of this stuff out. You really have to be bad. And you have to trust that badness is like being on a river, and you're floating downstream even though you don't realize it, and you're going to get there, but you have to go up these tributaries that are really quite ugly and terrible and embarrassing. And I could probably play you some audio tapes of early passes we made at the voiceover of Forrest Gump. And it's just god-awful. But we knew it was god-awful when we were doing it. I experienced it in some ways as well when I was doing a movie called Punchline, and I had to get up and do stand-up comedy in clubs, and I had no act. But it's a terrible feeling to get up on stage and bomb. But I knew that I had to get up on stage and bomb before I could get up on stage and be any good. And that was the only way of getting into the getting the research done and getting the material for the character. And so you sort of have to, like, put all of your self-consciousness aside and say, I'm really going to be terrible for about 6 weeks. And hopefully at the end of 6 weeks, we'll actually be on the right track.
Tom Hanks, from an interview recorded last April. His HBO miniseries, From the Earth to the Moon, has earned 17 Emmy nominations. HBO plans to rebroadcast the series on its signature channel in October, and the series will be available on digital video disc in November. Tom Hanks is starring in the new Nora Ephron film, You've Got Mail. It's slated to open at the end of the year. This is Fresh Air.